Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York on a second day in a row of significant subpoenas by the January 6th Select Committee, showing a clear determination on their part to march swiftly and relentlessly toward justice for the individuals and forces behind the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol. This time, the focus, the right-wing extremist groups and their leaders who played a role in the violence on that day and what appears to be premeditation of those events. The Proud Boys and their chairman, Enrique Tarrio, the Oath Keepers and its president, Elmer Stuart Rhodes, and the First Amendment Praetorian and its chairman, Robert Patrick Lewis. That's an organization that provided security at multiple rallies leading up to January 6th that amplified the ex-president's baseless claim that the election was stolen. In a statement, January 6th committee chairman Benny Thompson sums up today's subpoenas this way, quote, "The select committee is seeking information from individuals and organizations reportedly involved with the planning of the attack, with the violent mob that stormed the Capitol on January 6th, or with efforts to overturn the results of the election. We believe the individuals and organizations we subpoenaed today have relevant information about how violence erupted at the Capitol and the preparation leading up to this violent attack. And of course, open questions remain about the level of coordination between these organizations and their leaders and folks close to the president and the president himself, and why those connections are not known to us at this point. We have clear evidence of the ex-president's instructions to at least one of the groups indicted today and how those instructions were received by the group." Here was Trump in September to the Proud Boys.
"Do you want to call them? What do you want to call them? Give me a name. Give me a
white
name.
Supremacists and
white supremacists. Like
white supremacists and right
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by, but I'll tell you what, somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right-wing problem."
Stand back and stand by. And as Trump and his allies tried to frame that as, I don't know, some kind of half-hearted attempt to ask the militia group to stand down, not stand by, the militias heard him loud and clear. Here was Proud Boys chairman Enrique Tarrio in posts online after being name-checked by the president, according to reporting in the Washington Post. "So proud of my guys right now. Standing by, sir. Proud Boys. Lots of exclamation points. I will stand down, sir." That is, of course, before they showed up by the dozens on January 6th. The breaking news on the brand new January 6th subpoenas for the extremist groups on the front lines of the deadly insurrection is where we start today with some of our favorite reporters in France. New York Times congressional reporter Luke Broadwater is here. Also joining us, MSNBC legal analyst and former U.S. attorney Joyce Vance, former RNC chairman and former lieutenant governor of Maryland Michael Steele is here. And Christopher Goldsmith joins us, an Iraq war veteran and former U.S. Army sergeant who monitors domestic extremism and national security issues. Luke, I start with you. The January 6th committee members are not brining turkeys. They are pumping out subpoenas this week in a forceful display of some of the evidence they've already marshaled. I will read from some of these letters, but it is clear they know a lot about a lot.
Yes, and I think if you put these 2 days of subpoenas together, you get 2 more pieces to the puzzle they're building of what is either a few separate conspiracies that all come together or one giant conspiracy. And what they're trying to do with this last one is perhaps the most important part, because it gets to the actual violence that engulfs the Capitol on January 6th. We now have subpoenas out for the Proud Boys, for the Oath Keepers, and for the First Amendment Praetorian. And these are important because we know members of those groups have been indicted, have been charged with violent acts, with entering the Capitol on January 6th. And we also know members of those groups have connections, ties, associations, meetings, conversations with close allies to President Donald Trump. So what the committee hopes to get out of these documents and out of these interviews, if they can compel these militia groups to come in and submit to interviews, is exactly who was telling them what to do, who were they getting their instructions from, and who was giving them their guidance. And they hope that that will solve a big unanswered question here in what happened on January 6th.
I want to turn to Joyce about something you just said. I mean, 34 individuals associated with the Proud Boys have been indicted by DOJ, and all of them are working on lenient sentences. So we don't know what we don't know in terms of what has already been disclosed by them. But I want to come back to you quickly, Luke, because you have done the definitive piece of reporting on the extremist groups and their ties to Trump's allies, folks like Roger Stone and his closest, most extreme members in Congress. What jumps out to you from the perspective of having done that reporting about these groups and their role of providing security or the role of Republicans appearing at some of their events in this batch today?
Well, I mean, let's take the example of Stuart Rhodes, the president of the Oath Keepers. This is a man who publicly called for John McCain to be hung. He has a long history of violent rhetoric. And in the buildup to January 6th, he makes numerous public statements in which he is talking directly to allies of Mr. Trump and is encouraging what almost anybody would believe to be sort of violent rhetoric. He goes on Alex Jones's radio show and says Democrats are trying to steal the election, and he promises to put Oath Keepers out at the polls to help Mr. Trump. He later says that he has Oath Keepers standing by in D.C. He's at the Capitol on the day of the attack. He's in contact with people who have been arrested before, during, and after the attack. And so we just saw a subpoena come out for Alex Jones just recently. And Alex Jones says that someone from the White House told him to lead a march on the Capitol 2 days or 3 days before January 6th. So you can start to see how Stuart Rose is talking to Alex Jones. Alex Jones is talking to somebody at the White House. You can see why the committee is very interested in getting this testimony.
And Luke, I just want to make sure you meant Mike Pence, talking about hanging Mike Pence, not John McCain, right?
Oh, no. Stuart Rose called for John McCain to be hanged as well.
So this
was some years ago. But before John McCain died, Stuart Rhodes had an event in Arizona. Andy Biggs, who is the head of was the head of the Freedom Caucus, is there along with him. And he was angry over, something that has escapes memory at this point. But he said he should be hung by the neck until dead. And so, this dates back a while. Obviously, we saw it. The thing with some of these groups is for years they've been saying violent things and nothing came of it. And so now finally on January 6th, when something does come of it, all of a sudden you look back at all these things in the past and you say, why weren't people paying closer attention? And so I think that, and certainly in the build up to January 6th, where you have numerous public statements of violent rhetoric, that seems very clear now in retrospect.
So I want to, again, put a pen in the criminal investigation, because it is worth noting that the Select Committee made a point of presenting this in the letter, that 18 Oath Keepers have been indicted for the conspiracy, and Stuart Rhodes is person one in those indictments. But I just want to underscore this call to violence and how it circulated and how it swirled around Donald Trump with you, Chris Goldsmith. This is from the letter to Elmer Stuart Rhodes from the 1-6 Committee. On November 10th, 2020, days after the presidential election, you encouraged Oath Keepers to gather for the November 14th, 2020 Million MAGA March in Washington, D.C., stating, quote, our men will be standing by, awaiting the president's orders to call us up as the militia, which would override D.C.'s ridiculous anti-gun laws. And, quote, Oath Keepers will have some of the most skilled special warfare veterans standing by armed just outside D.C., end quote. That same post sought to encourage attendance by recalling when Serbians overthrew their own government. Under a header titled, quote, What We the People Must Do, you quoted a patriot from Serbia. Millions gathered in our capital. There were no barriers strong enough to stop them, nor the police determined enough to stop them. Police and military aligned with the people after a few hours of fistfight. We stormed the parliament and burned down fake state television. We won. So November 10th, I want to put up a video of what happened on January 6th. This is the described right here, November 10th. This is the hand-to-hand combat. Their models were in Serbia. This is what the assailants, the insurrectionists, did to the Capitol Police. This is new video released by DOJ yesterday. This is exactly what was planned and communicated to Donald Trump supporters and the militias who understood that their commander-in-chief would, quote, override D.C.'s ridiculous anti-gun laws. My question to you, Chris Goldsmith, is did these members believe they were operating in some sort of parallel paramilitary and that Donald Trump was the commander-in-chief?
Yes. In a word, yes. These people are completely delusional.
Chris Goldsmith has frozen up on. We're gonna get him back. Michael Steele, I want to come to you. When you listen to and we try to, without amplifying the rhetoric on the right, we try to monitor it and cover it as it intersects with the threat to the homeland of domestic violent extremism. But when you see the picture on January 6th of what they did, we should no longer be surprised that they did exactly what they believed Donald Trump wanted them to do.
Yeah, and I think something that Luke said should not get lost in this conversation because it is the predicate for everything in how we move forward. When he, you know, touched on the point that people are asking the question, you know, why weren't we paying attention to this? How did we miss this? And that's because we did not take it seriously. We did not think that this type of activity would lead to the level of violence that we saw, because in the past, even when you go back to the infestation of the John Birch Society inside the GOP, you had Republican leaders who excised that scourge, who did their level best to clarify for the public what we were, what we weren't, what we believed, and they tied it to the underpinnings of our democracy. Donald Trump came in and snipped all those cords. And then tied them to himself. So yeah. These individuals began to buy into the lunacy that he was commanding them to be the United States militia that he would call up, despite the District of Columbia role in such matters, et cetera. You know, it didn't matter to them. So it really does boil down to what we've missed. So now that we know what we've missed, what are we prepared to focus on? And I think that's what the January 6th Commission is really trying to hone in on, not just through the subpoenas, but by the aggressiveness of it to show, no, we're ready to fight back on this and reattach those cords, those bands that bind us together to our Constitution and this democracy.
Well, there are parallels at this point, Joyce Vance, to the work of the 9/11 Commission. I mean, I remember reading that report, and it is narrative in a way that these are now so narrative. Let me read from this letter, this subpoena for Mr. Rhodes, this section about the indictments, and ask you to explain to us what they're probing at that is separate from that criminal investigation. According to press reports, you are the individual referred to as person one in the indictment involving 18 Oath Keepers. The indictment explains that you were in direct contact with several of these members before, during, and shortly after the attack on the Capitol. Moments after the attack, you gathered approximately 100 feet from the Capitol with the Oath Keepers members who had just breached the building. Just gone inside. In written and spoken remarks delivered prior to January 6, 2021, you repeatedly suggested that the Oath Keepers should or were prepared to engage in violence to ensure their preferred election outcome. On Election Day, you declared that a, quote, honest election could only result in a win for Trump. called for Oath Keepers to operate as undercover poll watchers and encouraged your members to stock up on ammo and prepare for a full-on war in the streets. Rudy Giuliani, Mike Flynn, and Donald Trump called for trial by combat. What they meant is one part of the probe, but what was heard by the Oath Keepers is being very clearly established by the 1-6 Commission.
These letters that the committee is sending out goes far beyond what we normally see in subpoenas. This has, I think, become a way that the committee is trying to communicate just how much it knows and precisely where it's headed, both to the targets of their subpoenas, but also more generally to the public. So this is beginning to look like the search for connective tissue. It's fascinating that we've seen on back-to-back days subpoenas sent to people who were around the president. I mean, literally around the president, people who were involved in communications over these rallies at a very high level. And now today we see subpoenas going out to three of the largest white supremacist groups who were involved, all groups with violent ideation, all groups that to some extent harken back to the Turner Diaries, which is this sort of formative document for these violent groups that has a very violent and very hateful vision for the future of America. And so that connective tissue exists. The question is, what did it look like in advance of January 6th and on that day? Were these groups part of, as Michael said, a larger conspiracy? Are there separate conspiracies? What was communicated up to the White House? What caused some of these people who were involved in organizing the rally and with the women's groups involved in organizing the rally to develop a concern about violence that was so pressing that they decided that there was a need to communicate directly, at least with Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, to make sure that people in the White House saw that what they were seeing? So the committee, I think, is clearly intent on telling the American people the truth in a way that will be deeply satisfying. We are all, to some extent, dissatisfied by what's going on at DOJ, either because they're running a very strong, opaque investigation. You know, whatever they're doing, we don't know. Maybe they're not looking at this. Maybe they are. But that absence of transparency, I think, has been very frustrating for people who feel threatened by the ongoing risk to the country and want to know that something is being done. Now we're seeing something being done.
Chris Goldsmith is back with us. Chris, we lost you, but I want to understand what you understand from watching communications among these groups, among themselves, and to rally more members to their cause. And I want to read a little bit more from the subpoena for Henry Enrique Tarrio. It says this. Indictments returned by a federal grand jury in Washington, D.C. indicate that on December 19, 2020, a Stop the Steal protest event was announced for January 6. On December 29th, you posted the following message on Parler. We will not be wearing our traditional black and yellow. We will be incognito and will spread across downtown D.C. in smaller teams. Who knows? We might dress in all black for the occasion. On January 4th, you were arrested for the December 12, 2020 burning of a Black Lives Matter banner and barred from entering the District of Columbia on the following days. Though you were prevented from participating in the events at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, to date, 34 individuals affiliated with the Proud Boys have been indicted by DOJ in relation to the attack on the U.S. Capitol. Certain indictments returned against Proud Boys members describe prior planning and coordination, including efforts to fundraise for protective gear and communications. Furthermore, video evidence plainly demonstrates that Proud Boys members are involved in the January 6th attack. He wasn't even there. He wasn't supposed to be there. He is being examined and subpoenaed solely for his role prior to January 6th, organizing, planning, and inciting. Explain how much of that was going on.
So after the election, I was doing things that some other veterans were doing and joining these extremist organizations. Now, I was joining them because I wanted to know what they were planning. And I joined the Three Percenters. And during the screening, using basically my real profile as an Iraq veteran as a background, they were asking me questions about my weapon system, my secondary, meaning my handgun, how I was prepared to use it, what I would do in different tactical scenarios. And they explicitly asked, and I made recordings of these because these people are idiots and they don't see this kind of stuff coming. And they were explicitly asking, you know, would you kill someone from Antifa or Black Lives Matter if given the chance? And I wasn't, this wasn't an anomaly. I recorded a recruiting session of another veteran who was joining, I think, for legitimate reasons, or well, their reasons, the day prior. You know, and these are what my threat intelligence reports looked like in November, ahead of this January 6th insurrection. There were other folks. You know, we've seen Alexander, Alex Jones get targeted by the January 6th committee. What we haven't seen is Nick Fuentes and the America First PAC, who were literally riding in an armored, like, fake Humvee all around the country and practicing these insurrections at state capitals, trying to intimidate members of those local legislators and of governors to overturn the election. And what we saw on January 6th was, again, it was not a one-time event. It was not an anomaly that came out of nowhere. These folks planned it, and they did it out in the open. I mean, before they all got kicked off Facebook, like, the average person could get in there without doing any of the, without having to pretend to be a neo-Nazi like veterans like myself do to get close to these folks. You know, what I'm really looking forward to is more civil suits like we saw out of the Unite the Right neo-Nazi rally that the jury decided to hold something like $12 million against these folks. It's going to bankrupt a bunch of neo-Nazis. And that's why, you know, I'm saying, It's our Make a Nazi Cry segment. I'm super excited for everything that's going on today.
Let me just follow up on a couple of things you said. They asked you because they thought you were submitting yourself to be a participant in, was it the Oath Keepers or the Three Percenters?
As a division of the Three Percenters, there's all of these groups are, while Stuart Rhodes or Elmer Stuart Rhodes, these guys never use their real names, may run the Oath Keepers in a national setting. Groups like the Three Percenters, all it takes is, you know, somebody sees a patch at a gun shop, buys it, it says 3%. And now they say, oh, I've got a 3% chapter. And then they go on Facebook or Telegram or Gab and they create their own like local chapters. So there are highly centralized versions of these organizations. There are also like state level or local chapters. So what I joined was one out of Georgia, which had in the past been the largest and most active militia, unlawful militia in the United States. And thanks to infiltrators like myself, who, you know, report them to their internet service providers and their website hosts, they keep getting basically starting at square one. So my goal and organizations like We the Veterans and Veterans for American Ideals and Human Rights First are to knock these people off center. They have gone unopposed for years. You know, we've all been talking about, they've been talking about this violence out in the open and nobody's done anything. Well, now it's time to engage these people. And, you know, I'm not going to go out in the street with a weapon, dressing like I, you know, did in Iraq because I'm not an idiot. I could do all this from my home, you know, and other veterans who are interested, I would encourage them to do the same. What we want to do is make these groups so paranoid that they can't function. And, you know, I've been pretty successful at that. I've taken down a couple of hate groups just by myself. And if we see more vets doing this, I think it's going to be a great movement. And, you know, vets, we protect democracy. The Oath Keepers, they're not keeping any oath. It's folks like me engaging in this work who really are taking our oath to the country seriously and serving and protecting our democracy in a tangible way.
I guess I need to know then, Chris, how this was planned out in the open. Violence and conversations about what weapons would be used and the belief that they were doing what the president wanted them to do. How did that all go undetected by law enforcement if it was so clear to folks like yourself?
Law enforcement has been convincing themselves that these people have a First Amendment right, and they have been basically made afraid, and especially with the Trump administration and Bill Barr's Department of Injustice. Law enforcement was afraid to watch these folks as closely as I do. Now, I'm a civilian. I'm not a law enforcement official. I can go and buddy up to these people online, you know, make a fake profile, a fake Gab account, you know, and just copy and paste, repeat their rhetoric so they think I'm one of them. And then, you know, a few days go by of silence. And next thing you know, their conversations that I've recorded are ending up online. I've handed it off to anti-fascist activists on Twitter who will, you know, make sure to impose economic and social costs on these folks. Because the reality is, you don't want an oath keeper who is willing to take up arms and kill Americans working at your Dunkin' Donuts, right? You want to make sure that person is not able to function in our society as they quietly go about trying to undermine democracy and plan to kill Americans. You know, again, a lot of folks talk about in hyperbolic terms, especially in the Trump era, they do this false both sides-ism. There's no both sides-ism to stockpiling arms and planning to kill Americans. Like that is an exclusively far right thing. And Elmer Stuart Rhodes of the Oath Keepers is a huge part of convincing veterans who are in vulnerable positions because of their service in Iraq and Afghanistan to join. You know, the guy has a degree from Yale Law School, which to my knowledge has not been rescinded yet. So when someone like me, who I was 21 when I got out of the military, was in really rough shape, when I was running into people like the Oath Keepers, they were looking for folks like me, and I'm just going to trust the guy with a Yale Law degree.
Chris Goldsmith, thank you for adding, and I mean this in all the right ways, your firsthand knowledge of what these groups are really like to our understanding of today's batch of subpoenas. I'm really grateful to call on you. There's much more on today's breaking news. Congressman Jerry Connolly joins us next. Don't go anywhere.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock. When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Racially motivated violent extremism, specifically of the sort that advocates for the superiority of the white race, is a persistent, evolving threat. It's the biggest chunk of our racially motivated violent extremism cases, for sure. And racially motivated violent extremism is the biggest chunk of our domestic terrorism portfolio, if you will, overall. I will also say that the same group of people we're talking about have been responsible for the most lethal attacks over the last, say, decade.
And many of those groups also being subpoenaed today by the 1-6 Select Committee. The chairman of that committee writing this, quote, "The Select Committee is seeking information from individuals and organizations reportedly involved with planning the attack, with the violent mob that stormed the Capitol on January 6th, or with efforts to overturn the results of the election." Joining our conversation and our coverage, Congressman Jerry Connolly of Virginia, member of the House Oversight and Foreign Affairs Committees. One of our earliest conversations, Congressman, after January 6th was this sense and this clarity that you had about a conspiracy that had taken place. And it sounded like a certainly a plausible theory, but I couldn't see all the pieces. This batch of subpoenas makes clear that what the 1-6 committee is piecing together is clearly a conspiracy of state actors, government actors, extremist groups, and Donald Trump's campaign operatives. Tell me how you see this coming together, and if you still believe in that theory of a conspiracy to overturn the will of the American voter in 2020.
I do, Nicole. That doesn't mean that everybody involved was involved in a conspiracy, but there's no question this was planned in advance. There's no question far right, extremist, white supremacist, fascist groups planned to do something violent on January 6th at the nation's capital. They came equipped with, you know, scaling ladders, with plastic cufflinks. Things
zip
to
ties.
Cuff you with.
Yeah,
zip ties. Thank you. Zip ties. And, you know, that's not a spontaneous demonstration. That's something planned in advance. And, of course, we know from email traffic on social media prior to that, they actually made no secret of their intentions to do something violent, to try to disrupt the counting of the ballots on January 6th. So when Mark Meadows says these subpoenas are unprecedented, somebody needs to remind Mr. Meadows, so was January 6th. An insurrection in the nation's capital is unprecedented.
And, you know, this batch includes all of the calls for violence. I want to read some to you. This one is a letter that accompanies the subpoena for Robert Patrick Lewis. He's the chairman of the First Amendment Praetorian. And it says this: the First Amendment Praetorian provided security to the Million MAGA March on November 14, 2020, including providing protection to Ali Alexander. You describe your coordination with Mr. Alexander as, quote, tight at the hip. You later claim that you provided security for General Mike Flynn at the Jericho March in D.C. on December 12, 2020, and have claimed to coordinate closely and regularly with General Flynn. You've also claimed to coordinate closely with Sidney Powell. On January 4th, the First Amendment Praetorian Twitter account suggested that violence was imminent. Quote, there may be some young National Guard captains facing some very, very tough choices in the next 48 hours. Pray with every fiber of your being that their choices are wise, just, and fearless. I want to put up the video that DOJ released yesterday of the combat that the law enforcement officials who protected the members of Congress of both political parties and the Capitol itself and Vice President Mike Pence, these were Donald Trump supporters, perhaps some of these extremist group members themselves, attacking Capitol Police that day. What is your sense with these letters that go back to all of the incitement of violence going back to November and December meetings in Washington in terms of how far back this committee is looking at these individuals and their incitement?
Well, as I said, this didn't happen all by itself spontaneously on January 6th. President Trump himself was urging people to come to Washington on that date, as were other of his acolytes. The Proud Boys and their ilk were absolutely on social media months in advance of January 6th, after the election, urging people to come to disrupt the process. Now, clearly, they had violence in mind. And I think that clip you showed of FBI Director Wray is very instructive. The FBI, hardly a liberal bastion, has described these right-wing terrorist groups as a direct threat to our democratic way of life and our democratic institutions. In fact, they're the ones perpetrating violence more often than any other set of groups in America. They are something to be concerned about. And so I think the January 6th committee is doing its job in trying to get to the bottom of the planned and prepared violence that these groups were engaged in.
Congressman, the two Republicans who serve on the committee do so at great risk to their, not just their political careers, but their safety and well-being. What does it say to you that being part of a committee investigating a deadly attack on the Capitol risks their lives from the right in American political life?
I think it says a lot, tragically, about the Republican Party that has not so subtly allowed a violent wing of its own establishment to enter into the temple and to become part of the political environment. That is very dangerous. And the fact that only two Republicans can be counted on right now to enforce the investigative work of the January 6th committee says volumes about the state of the Republican Party and the Republican caucus in the House, tragically. And it is something that worries me every day in terms of what other compromises are you willing to make that effectively erode democracy and faith in democracy in America.
Let me bring you back in, Michael Steele. I mean, this is the other side of the coin, right? It is clear. The subpoena letters and the footnotes read like the final product of the Mueller report with the footnotes and the annotations. They have laid over Donald Trump's Twitter feed with the public statements and probably hours and hours of and bless the heart of whoever had to listen to these right wing programs, podcasts, shows, whatever they are. They have laid over the statements of all these individuals. They have found the intersectionality with the groups organizing the events at which they spoke. And they've obviously laid them over to some sources inside Donald Trump's inner circle campaign or White House. It's unclear from reading these. But the truth will emerge. And I guess my question for you is, to whom will that matter?
You asked the right question. You would hope, maybe even think, out of natural course of things, that it would matter certainly to those on the Republican side who at least pretend to leadership. They want to govern the nation beginning in 2023, assuming they take control of the House. But what do you do with it? What's the first thing you do when you take control of the House in 2023? Well, we're going to end any discussion or investigation into January 6th. Is that the first act of the new Republican Congress? So this really means a lot in this moment, not just for the members of the committee, Nicole, who are poring over those documents and listening to the evidence and trying to pull together and figure out exactly what happened, who was involved, et cetera. But it needs to matter to the American people. Mm-hmm. Because you're now going to be confronting in the next 12 months a very, very important decision about handing the reins of power of this federal government back into the hands of people who deny anything that happened on January 6th and who themselves have professed the reinstatement of the man who orchestrated the attack on this great nation. So, this work is important. But it runs the risk of ending in the next Congress with the leadership that has already professed their lack of care, not even interest. They don't even give a damn about this. I mean, they're penalizing the Republican members who served and supported this. They're willing to take out their own. That's how little they care about the American people. What are they thankful for? They're thankful for Donald Trump. What are we thankful for as we go into this holiday as a nation? We're thankful that we survived January 6th, damn it. And now we're going to be confronted based on the congressman's right. He's legitimately concerned, not out of some partisan configuration. He gets elected like everybody else to serve and represent his people. But that becomes more and more difficult when those who are being sent to the Congress really don't give a damn about the country, and they're more interested in supporting and lifting up the Proud Boys than taking them down. That's why what Christopher said in the last segment was so important for how we kind of begin to look at this. We can no longer put the blinders on and keep them on when it comes to this very fragile democracy that we have.
And Luke, that was your point, too, that this violent rhetoric has been part of what these groups traffic in since their inception. The variable here was that they were elevated by Donald Trump, not just into the mainstream, but to replace the mainstream. Michael Steele and I used to be the mainstream of the Republican Party, if you can imagine that. I don't often like to remind folks of that. But Donald Trump, the sort of chemical impact of Donald Trump was to purge out, and Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger are the perfect illustration of this in real time, to purge anyone who refused to lie. And Donald Trump told us what he was going to do at a rally in 2017. He told his supporters, don't believe what you hear, don't believe what you see, only believe what I tell you. I mean, he programmed them to only believe him. But the elevation of these groups was Donald Trump and Donald Trump and Donald Trump. And now the endurance of Donald Trump's desire to have the white supremacist groups that Christopher Wray bravely tried to warn people about. That video was from March, before the election, I believe. You testified to it again in September, 2 months before the election, about these groups. And again, this year, since Joe Biden has been in office. My question is, so the committee has now focused in on the state actors, the government people they're interested in. They have focused on the campaign folks that they think were involved or might have information. They have focused on the money. They've sent a subpoena to the folks that move money through the 501c4. They've focused on the social media buys. They've focused on the women for Trump. They've focused on the white supremacists. Are the lawmakers next, Luke?
You know, that's a good question, because there's a lot of reluctance among members of Congress to hold each other accountable. And, you know, the members of this committee have said openly that they will stop at nothing. They will subpoena Donald Trump. They will subpoena members of Congress if it comes to it. But to date, we have not seen that. I do know that there's some feeling among some of the staff to the committee, some of the investigators, that if Republicans take control of Congress, maybe they could be on the end of, frivolous investigations into themselves, and they could face some sort of pushback on that. But I do think that if the more they discover as they talk to these different groups about who they were communicating with, who they were getting instructions from, if any of that ends up leading to some member of Congress, they're going to have to call them in. So I do think that that is still a distinct possibility, and it may well happen. I think it also is good to remember that this committee has at least another year probably to work on this. I know there's been talk about them finishing in early spring, but just because they haven't called somebody yet doesn't mean that that isn't going to happen eventually. They just may want to have more information in hand before they ask that person to come in.
Oh, that's such a good point. Congressman, I'll give you the last word.
Well, I think we need to focus particularly on the enabling of violence in our politics by one of the two parties. We just censored Paul Gosar for threatening the life of a member of Congress and the President of the United States. Marjorie Taylor Greene was censored because she issued emails and texts threatening the Speaker of the House. Matt Gaetz just said he'd hire Kyle Rittenhouse as an intern, a young man acquitted, but nonetheless who murdered two individuals and shot a third. What is happening in terms of normalizing violence in our politics? If we go down that road, and if the Republican Party embraces that as a tool of winning campaigns, this country is in for a world of trouble.
Luke Broadwater, Congressman Jerry Connolly, thank you both so much for being part of our coverage. More breaking news this afternoon. When we come back, a jury has found the organizers of that deadly 2017 right-wing rally in Charlottesville responsible for the violence that day, awarding more than $25 million in damages. We'll tell you about that when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We're also following the breaking news out of Charlottesville, where a jury there has decided in the landmark civil case involving the white supremacists who organized the deadly 2017 Unite the Right rally. The jury finding the defendants guilty on 4 of the 6 claims involving state conspiracy law and assault, awarding more than $25 million in punitive and compensatory damages to the plaintiffs, who were arguing that the white supremacists violated the civil rights of minorities by plotting the violence beforehand. The jury deadlocked on two claims centered around a federal law that the organizers conspired to commit racially motivated violence. We're back with Joyce and Michael Steele. Joyce, take us through what happened and what this verdict means.
Well, this is a very important verdict. It shows us that civil cases can have as much, if not more, impact than a criminal case can. And the strategy that was used here by Robbie Kaplan, one of the lead attorneys on the case, harkens back to litigation the Southern Poverty Law Center used in the 1980s to bankrupt the Ku Klux Klan. When you impose these sort of big judgments, $25 million, you now have the ability to attach all of the resources of these groups and these individuals and simply, you know, to take away any ability that they have to continue in their current form. The Klan, for instance, had to turn over its headquarters to the mother of one of its victims. These are powerful images, but it also disrupts these groups in a way that we hope law enforcement will do, but in some ways has not been able to. And so this is now a moment where we've identified what these groups can no longer do. They can no longer hold these rallies where they are responsible for violence that takes place or they are at risk of these big multi-million dollar judgments.
Joyce, explain the counts on which the jury was deadlocked, because those I understood those to be the ones that emerged from the Ku Klux Klan Act. And this is from the Times reporting. The federal charges on which the jury deadlocked related to whether the defendants had engaged in a race-based violent conspiracy, which is illegal under an 1871 federal law known as the KKK Act that was designed to prevent vigilantes from denying newly freed slaves their civil rights. The plaintiffs said they would seek a retrial on the federal charges. Explain that and tell us what that looks like.
The federal civil rights charges are powerful charges that can be used in situations like this. We don't have any indication yet why the jury hung. We do know that the judge encouraged them to try to deliberate through the problems that they were having and ultimately said that they were unable to reach a unanimous verdict. So whether that means one or two jurors were having trouble or whether overall there was a concern, we just don't know. But now the lawyers who brought this case can turn around and can ask if they choose to have those charges retried. I don't know, frankly, Nicole, whether they will. They've won a significant victory on the other counts. There's perhaps some marginal utility to going back on these counts. But knowing that a jury has hung in this setting, they may just as well decide that they're happy with what they've achieved here and decide that their purpose is accomplished.
Michael Steele, I know no viewers of this program forget the horrors of what this was, but I want to read from the Times reporting on it all the same. The trial brought to life the hatred and anger espoused by the far-right groups, especially on the streets of Charlottesville. A torch-lit march on the eve of the rally with hundreds of men chanting racist slogans evoked KKK and Nazi marches. The testimony, as well as the many videos and social media posts introduced, were awash in the iconography of hate with Nazi symbols and stiff-arm salutes with admiration for Hitler and claims that non-white races were inferior. I am a student of what Chris Goldsmith talked about, some of the messaging circulating on the far right. And while this victory is significant, it has not abated. And we should not forget that this was a flashpoint in Donald Trump's presidency as well. And as memorable as his comments were about individuals on both sides, John Kelly's head hung in what only appeared like shame and disgust will also be seared in my mind forever.
Well, and it's too bad that the heads of others inside the GOP didn't hang as well in disgust and shame for that moment. But the silence said a lot. And I think the reality is that when you give license to something like this, it gets bolder. It becomes emboldened. It finds a freshness to its activities that we have spent a very long time. We fought a civil war over trying to snuff that out because it is in contravention of the ideals of this country. And there are no doubts. 400 years, it's an ugly history. And there's a lot about it that a lot of folks today don't want to talk about. They don't want exposed, and they certainly don't want to see African Americans tell that story in their own words, their own lived experience of how they grew up in this America dealing with all of this. And to have that moment unfold the way it did in Charlottesville was more than just a smack in the face or turn away from the efforts to repudiate that. But it was an embrace by our political leadership that we're now seeing play out in a myriad of ways, Nicole, that I think send out a clarion call to the country and asking the question, is this who you want to be? Because this is what we've come through. And now, do you want more of this? And what are you willing to sacrifice as a nation to put it down? And I'm not talking about violence. This is not about, oh, let's meet violence with violence. You know, the gospel for all those card carrying good Christians out there who like to quote the gospel, but yet still embrace this stuff. Remember, the Lord said, turn the other cheek, right? There were other ways to deal with the violent acts of others. And that's what a civil society has to bring itself to. Not meet it on that battlefield, but to do like King and others had espoused and saying, we can take down the ugliness, we can take down the evil, but by not becoming ugly and evil ourselves. And when the party stepped into that by saying that they're fine people on both sides, it was a turning point that we now have to account for, I believe.
And we're living with the repercussions every single day and moving in the wrong direction. In case I don't see either of you before Thursday, I am so thankful for both of you. Thank you so much for being part of this hour and so many of our hours. We are nothing without all of you. Joyce Vance, Michael Steele, thank you so much and happy Thanksgiving. The next hour of Deadline White House starts after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
I was appalled, like you, at the violence and destruction that we saw that day. I was appalled that you, our country's elected leaders, were victimized right here in these very halls. That attack, that siege, was criminal behavior, plain and simple, and it's behavior that we, the FBI, view as domestic terrorism. It's got no place in our democracy, and tolerating it would make a mockery of our nation's rule of law.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York. Take it from FBI Director Christopher Wray. The January 6th attack was an act of domestic terrorism, plain and simple. The worst attack on the heart of our democracy in more than 200 years, organized and methodically planned in part by right-wing extremist groups. Now, as part of its effort to leave no stone unturned in its investigation into the insurrection, the January 6th Select Committee is looking to understand the role of those extremist groups in the Capitol attack. Breaking just this afternoon, the committee has issued subpoenas to the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, as well as their leaders, as well as a lower-profile extremist group called the First Amendment Praetorians. The crush of subpoenas, 10 issued in just the last 24 hours, underscores the urgency of their effort to get to the truth of the forces behind the insurrection and to explore the role of the ex-president of the United States. The committee warning in court documents yesterday, quote, future elections are imminent and there could be future attacks on democracy rooted in conduct occurring well before the election. The select committee's task to study and suggest legislation to ensure that January 6th is not repeated and that our nation's democracy is protected from future attacks is urgent. The committee making that legal argument in response to an increasingly desperate effort by the disgraced, twice impeached ex-president to block the committee from accessing White House files related to the attack. Those are housed at the National Archives. But the committee is also facing off against a persistent effort by Trump World to obstruct their investigation. Politico writes today about the ongoing standoff with top Trump aides that the committee has previously subpoenaed. Politico writes this, quote, 2 months after the January 6th Select Committee subpoenaed them, two of Donald Trump's top White House aides are locked in a standoff with the panel, and the indictment of Trump ally Steve Bannon appears to have done little to change their calculus. Former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and longtime Trump social media manager Dan Scavino, the first Trump White House official subpoenaed by the House's January 6th investigators, have yet to provide documents or testimony to investigators. The committee's protracted ongoing negotiations with both men have yet to yield breakthroughs. In Meadows' case, it's led to yet another threat of criminal contempt of Congress charges. The January 6th committee racing against the clock to investigate every aspect of the deadly insurrection is where we start this hour with some of our favorite reporters in France. MSNBC political analyst, the former Congresswoman Donna Edwards is here. Also joining us, Matt Dowd, former chief strategist to George W. Bush's reelection campaign, now a Democratic candidate for Texas lieutenant governor. And Carol Lenig is here, Washington Post national reporter and co-author of the best-selling book, I Alone Can Fix It. Carol Lenig, you were also the author of that epic investigation into the insurrection. And I wonder, with your reporting and all of your sort of visibility into what happened, how do you see today's batch of subpoenas into the extremist groups, name-checked by Christopher Wray, and their leaders?
I think it's pretty interesting, and you hit the nail on the head, Nicole, when you mentioned the committee racing against the clock, racing against the midterm elections clock, but also racing against the clock to build a more fleshy and full narrative of what happened. What's really interesting about the last 24, 48 hours, Monday and Tuesday, two series of subpoenas, is that based on my reporting, there's an interlocking web between the people who were subpoenaed on Monday and the people who were subpoenaed on Tuesday. I'll give you one example. Often overlooked is that Roger Stone, in addition to being a loyal sort of soldier of Donald Trump's and a dirty trickster over the course of his history for all sorts of political campaigns and for Trump specifically, was guarded on the time of the January 6th protest by some oath keepers, some of whom were arrested in the course of the actual insurrection slash storming of the Capitol. I'll let people choose their own words. And that's really interesting. He's also believed to exchange a lot of communications with Oath Keepers leader Stuart Rhodes. So keep in mind, Roger Stone gets subpoenaed on Monday by the committee, hasn't complied, I'm pretty sure, in terms of providing any information or documentation. But 24 hours later, you have the head of the Oath Keepers, the ostensible head of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, also a huge Trump champion, and the leader of a group of people, 18 of whom are implicated in this storming of the Capitol. The two of them in contact on January 5th and 6th with some calls the day before the storming of the Capitol.
So I'm not an investigative reporter, but I've interviewed Carol Lenig enough to be able to pull out the two things she's tying together in her observations. And let me share it with all of you. This is from the subpoena of Roger Stone yesterday. The investigation and public reports have revealed credible evidence of your involvement in the events within the scope of the Select Committee's inquiry. According to documents provided to the Select Committee, press reports and statements by you, you were in Washington, D.C. on January 5th. And January 6th to attend and speak at rallies in support of then President Trump and his allegations of election fraud. Specifically, you spoke on January 5th at rallies at the U.S. Supreme Court held by a group affiliated with the Three Percenters and Freedom Plaza held by the 80% Coalition and were originally scheduled to speak at the January 6th rally at the Ellipse held by Women for America before traveling to Washington. You promoted your upcoming appearance at a January 6th Stop the Steal event and solicited donations from supporters to pay for security by directing them to stopthesteal.org. While in Washington, you reportedly used members of the Oath Keepers as personal security guards, several of whom were reportedly involved in the attack on the Capitol, and at least one of whom has been indicted. Here is the 1-6 committee's letter about the Oath Keepers. Individuals associated with the Oath Keepers organization were similarly involved in planning and participating in the violent attack on the Capitol on January 6. 18 members of the Oath Keepers were indicted by a federal grand jury for allegedly planning a coordinated attack to storm the Capitol, including by traveling to Washington, D.C. with paramilitary gear and supplies. Elmer Stewart Rhodes is president of Oath Keepers. Prior to January 6, Rhodes repeatedly suggested the Oath Keepers should engage in violence to ensure their preferred election outcome. Carol, Roger Stone picked them. They were very public. They were telling people to arm up and come to Washington with, quote, paramilitary gear and supplies. Roger Stone didn't have any sort of plausible explanation for not knowing precisely what was going to happen that day. Tell me how much these subpoenas suggest that premeditation and conspiracy and how far the tentacles go into Trump's inner political circle. How much do you think that is in focus reading these letters?
You know, I always shy away from predicting, speculating, suggesting that which I cannot publish in the newspaper with the standards of the Washington Post, very high standards. But I will say that your sniffer is very attuned. I see behind this, as an investigative reporter, an effort on the part of the committee to tie and investigate the potential ties to the president, and especially the former president's knowledge of what was going on. You know, it's sort of, we use this phrase quite often in news meetings, but it sort of strains credulity to think that Roger Stone, somebody who was always trying to enable and help Donald Trump achieve his ends through whatever methods he saw fit, chose to be protected by a group that was in public and private domestic chatter recommending violence on January 6th, urging its members to come armed to Washington, D.C., helping organize and enable the possibility of coming armed to Washington, D.C. among its members. It's hard to, it strains again credulity to think that Roger Stone accidentally, coincidentally chose this group without knowing its goals. And then, of course, the committee's view has got to be, it strains credulity that the president at the time, Donald Trump, did not know about this group that Roger Stone had aligned himself with and that was aligning itself with, as they called him, Big Daddy. Some of these domestic extremists were referring to the president as, you know, Daddy has called us to Washington. Time to saddle up.
And I'm sure in some sad, sick way, the state will pay for whatever therapy it takes to unpack that. I'm going to leave it alone. Donna Edwards, we have so much of what went on that went on in public view. So what the subpoenas add is, and I've used this, I'm going to use it one more time, the second volume of the Mueller report, the obstruction report, it was really in all those footnotes where you learned that what the Mueller investigators did was they investigated their witnesses, and those interviews were made up the narrative of that second volume on obstruction. But it was clear that they were also laying over Donald Trump's tweets and the news reports and the way Donald Trump reacted to the news reports. It is clear from the last 24 hours of subpoenas that what the 1-6 committee has done is they've looked at everything that happened in full view. Donald Trump said, come to Washington, it's going to be great. His political operations, the Women for America First, spent money bringing people to Washington. Those people included white supremacist groups that Alex Jones and his fill-ins said, come, be ready, it's going to be epic, it's a revolution. I mean, this all happened in full view. And what the committee seems to be doing is showing its witnesses, 150 have already talked to them. We only talk about the ones that defy those subpoenas. We don't know what we don't know about who those 150 include. But what is your sense of what is still missing in terms of their probe?
Well, first of all, I think that we heard from Chairman Thompson when the committee was formed that they intended to get to the before, during, and after what happened in the White House, what happened on Capitol Hill, and what happened with these outside players leading up to and after January 6th. And I think what we're seeing is, one, the committee has an array of documents, public statements, and other testimony from other witnesses that it is beginning to piece together. What we don't really quite know yet, although we can suspect it from reading some of the documents, is the direct link between President Trump and his team at the White House, with their campaign team, with the people who ended up marching to and storming violently into the Capitol. And I think that the testimony that will come forward is going to fill in some of those holes. And these witnesses may think for a temporary time period that they can avoid complying with these subpoenas. But I think that this committee has made very clear that it intends to enforce its subpoenas. And there are going to be people who are outside of the total inner circle who are not going to be able to just avoid a subpoena from the Congress of the United States. And eventually they will have to comply. Now, the question will be how much of this can be done in time, not just to lay out what happened, but also to do the other work of the committee, which is make recommendations for legislation and get those things in place before the November election and certainly before the end of this term of the Congress.
You know, Matt Dowd, it was said during both the impeachments of Donald Trump and the Mueller probe that what they really needed, what Mueller had to find, was a smoking gun of obstruction. He found six. What the first impeachment managers had to find was a smoking gun that Donald Trump abused his office. The transcript was stuffed in like the meat locker of servers, and it came out because of whistleblowers. And the smoking gun went right next to Mueller's six smoking guns of obstructive conduct. And then the third investigation was Donald Trump's second impeachment by Congress, the most bipartisan impeachment vote and the most bipartisan conviction vote in our country's history. And what the Democrats and Republicans who impeached Trump found, and what the Democrats and Republicans who voted to convict Donald Trump found, was that he clearly incited a deadly insurrection whose mission statement was to, quote, hang Mike Pence against the U.S. Capitol. And my question to you is, what does this committee have to find? Because three investigations have yielded three smoking guns, and I've lost the thread on what needs to be proven about Donald Trump.
Well, I actually think, I'm glad there's a bunch of subpoenas out there. It just add to more subpoenas out there. My problem right now is the lack of urgency about what is actually fundamentally happening in our country today. We're focused on so many different things, but really to me, the fundamental thing is what occurred on January 6th and then the aftermath of January 6th. January 6th is almost a year ago. And not one person in power has been held accountable yet. Not one person. And not only have we not done anything to buttress our democracy in the after of January 6th by passing laws, encouraging people to practice norms, all of those things, it's actually gotten worse since January 6th. It's now more acceptable to do what happened on January 6th. There, at least in the aftermath of right after January 6th, there were some Republicans that spoke out against it. Now they're actually speaking out for that type of activity in this. And so when we get in this situation, I think we're now so far removed in most Americans' mind from January 6th that we're sitting here in almost December and Thanksgiving of the year, that they're off on some other focus, which is American public is on many different things. And now they're thinking about Thanksgiving and football and all of that. But the lack of urgency, and I think the lack of accountability, I'll give you an analogy to this situation that I think is very apropos. This is like a bunch of people showing up at a bank in a small town. And some of the officers of the bank walk outside and lie to them and say, you have a right to go in there and take the money. The money was taken from you wrongly. Go in there and take the money. And the people go, okay, great. And they storm the bank and they go in there and take the money. And the only people right now that have been held accountable were the people that were lied to and instigated and told to go do something based on some complete big lie and wrong principle. And they went in there. Not a single of the officers of the bank, and I would actually add, not a single of the officers of the government have been held accountable in one iota of this, almost a year in the aftermath. And as I added also, is we've done nothing nothing. And we've actually diminished the protections of our democracy in the 10 months that have happened since January 6th. And so unless we grasp some level of urgency and people are held accountable, we often talk about the line between right and wrong and between peaceful protest and terrorism. But if nobody's held accountable, there is no line. There is no line. We should quit saying there's a line until somebody is held accountable at some level of power.
Well, there are no lines. And I mean, I take Matthew's point. Things have gotten worse. I mean, things are so, you understand how bad things are at Fox News. They're so bad that Brett Baer is calling them out. And I want to read some reporting from NPR. We cover Fox News because a whole bunch of people watch Fox News, and Tucker Carlson is one of the biggest purveyors of conspiracy theories and disinformation that sit at the heart of a current and ongoing domestic violent extremism threat issued by the Department of Homeland Security. NPR reports this. Veteran figures on Fox's news side, including political anchor Brett Baer, shared their objections with Fox News Media CEO Suzanne Scott and its president of news, Jay Wallace. Those objections rose to Lachlan Murdoch, the chairman and CEO of the network's parent company, Fox Corp. And here's Brett Baer getting interrogated, questioned by his colleague, Brian Kilmeade, in what to me sounds like a very awkward exchange. Let me play that.
And, you know, I watched the feature with Tucker, and I watched it on Fox Nation. Interesting perspective I didn't get before, but I didn't get hurt by it. I didn't get damaged by it. Were you bothered by it? Because that's the reporting.
There's, Brian, I don't want to go down this road. And okay. You know, I mean, there were concerns about it, definitely. And I think that the news division did what we do. I mean, we covered the story, and you know, I wanted to do all of that internally. Steve and Jonah made their decision, and it's their decision.
I watched Brett Baer's anchoring of the days before, sort of right after the election, and what Brett Baer is doing cannot be overlooked. He is standing inside the largest purveyor of lies about the election, the largest amplification of Donald Trump's ongoing lies that are at the heart of an ongoing threat to the homeland, and saying, yeah, I'm uncomfortable. I covered the story. And he's talking in that clip about two lifelong conservatives who quit the network. And I wonder, you know, Matt's point about there being no lines. A line was drawn by two conservatives this week, Donna, who quit Fox News. But I tried to draw that line with Chris Christie, who wrote a book. On the cover of the book is the word fighting conspiracy theories and liars. There's not a word about Fox News as a purveyor of conspiracy theories and liars. Nobody watching this show is a threat. No one watching this show is trafficking in the grievances or the lies about a stolen election. And I wonder, Donna, if we're getting to the point where even if the 1-6 committee proves beyond any reasonable doubt that Donald Trump knowingly and intentionally plotted a coup with John Eastman as the intellectual architect of the whatever, the sort of perversion of the Constitution, Mike Pence, who failed to do what Trump wanted him to do. I mean, they prove all the pieces of the president, the Justice Department, the Pentagon, the Congress, the allies, the R's that he mentioned, acting AG Rosen, the extremist groups who came to Washington as they were told to do, Roger Stone, who was in the car. They could prove the whole thing. What impact would it have?
Well, I think it's a good question, Nicole. I mean, I think all of us who care about democracy and democratic principles and constitutional governance are worried about exactly the same thing. And it is, as Matt expressed, that the lack of urgency on trying to shore up our systems doesn't seem to quite be there yet to match the urgency of the moment. And I guess my concern is that I think that there are going to be a set of people, maybe it's one third, I don't know what it is, it's very vocal, that will never under any circumstances accept any report that comes from the January 6th committee or from the Congress. But that doesn't mean that it's not important for us to engage in the exercise of finding out what happened, why it happened, and to try to do what we can to prevent it. The danger for us would be if we just accept that we can't do anything and all sit back and watch our democracy fade away. I'm not willing to do that.
The perfect place to plot. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Nicole, can I just say one thing? I would just like to remind everybody that from 1933 to 1945, Germany rebuilt their infrastructure. Germany got inflation under control, and Germany's wages went up in the course of that, and the economy was robust. And in the midst of 1933 to 1945, they lost their democracy. So let's keep in mind that we can have all these other things we deal with. And in the middle of it, if we don't tend to what we need to tend to in the garden of democracy, we can deal with all these other issues. We lose our democracy.
Matt Dowd, Carol Lenig, thank you for starting us off this hour. Donna sticks around. When we come back, Republicans across the country are working to make it harder to vote. And in Michigan, they may have found a way to get around that state's Democratic governor in their assault on democracy. That story's next. Plus, yesterday's batch of subpoenas included familiar names like Roger Stone and Alex Jones, but two other conservative operatives who were subpoenaed, a man named Dustin Stockton and a woman named Jennifer Lawrence, have been described as the Bonnie and Clyde of MAGA world. And we'll bring you their story later in the program. And why is the RNC agreeing to pay some of the twice impeached disgraced ex-president's legal bills? We'll explain. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Michigan was a major flashpoint in the disgraced ex-president's attempts to overturn the 2020 election results. And while his efforts were ultimately not successful, Michigan's now back as a central front in the fight to protect American democracy. Republicans in the state are about to force through voting laws that would make it harder for many people in Michigan to cast their ballots. They're attempting to do so without Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer's signature. How, you might ask? Well, there's a loophole in the state's constitution that allows them to use a petition drive, which requires signatures of just 4% of registered voters in the state. The Detroit Free Press reports this, quote, Michigan's process for approving voter-initiated legislation stands out as a national outlier in allowing lawmakers to enact changes proposed by a minority of voters whose proposals are not subject to either a popular vote or the governor's approval. Joining us now is Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson. Also joining us, Charlie Sykes, columnist and editor-at-large of The Bulwark and MSNBC contributor. Donna's still here. Secretary Benson, tell us what's happening.
Well, you know, notably today is the one-year anniversary of our State Board of Canvassers in Michigan certifying the results of the 2000 November election. And it's remarkable that here we are a year later, still battling the misinformation about the truth of that election. And it's misinformation that's manifested itself in this very un-American, anti-democratic effort to change the rules and the policies that enabled so many citizens to vote in record numbers in a very secure election process that over 250 audits in our state have affirmed as accurate, and instead use this very loophole that you mentioned in our Constitution to change those rules and do things like make it more difficult for citizens to identify themselves before receiving an absentee ballot or voting from home, and make it more difficult for our local election administrators to do things like have churches and schools serve as polling places by eliminating needed funding sources and philanthropic sources for running our elections. So it's a pernicious effort to make it more difficult, not just for citizens to vote, but more difficult for us to run secure elections. And it's not being presented to citizens in that way, of course. It's being misrepresented, which is another manifestation of the way that lies are being used to dismantle our democracy.
Madam Secretary, were there any instances of voter fraud, widespread voter fraud, that would have changed the result of Michigan's 2020 election?
Nope. And if there had been any, one would have taken it seriously and held those accountable. but we would have discovered it. This has been the most scrutinized election in our state's history and our country's history. And I think at this point, my hope is that we spend the next year really looking at how we replicate the high turnout, replicate the high security that led to a successful election, instead of battling this misinformation and still trying to find accountability for those who propagated, promoted it. Yet here we are instead, trying to inform voters about the way in which this loophole in the law is being used to potentially dismantle protections and access to the vote that they have taken advantage of and used to vote in such record numbers.
Do Republicans in the state back this? And if they do, is it because they believe the lies? They believe that there was fraud in Michigan? I mean, what problem do people think they're trying to solve there?
What's a political strategy? It's a political strategy to continue to plant seeds of doubt among citizens that their elections are not secure, even though we know that they are. And it's a political strategy, ultimately, I think, to dampen turnout, to deter citizens from not just being engaged in voting, but ultimately holding their elected officials accountable. Now, notably, there are Republican state legislators, particularly the State Senate Oversight Committee, that have found and concluded that our results of our election through their own investigation were accurate and our election procedures were secure. And so there really is no reason to try to mess with the elections process in a way and in such an undemocratic way that will only result in making it more confusing and difficult for citizens to vote, thereby dampening turnout, and by making it more difficult for us to run our elections securely, thereby, setting the stage, ironically, for potentially more problems and challenges in the future.
Charlie Sykes, the threats to democracy are happening every day. They're happening at a pace that we can barely keep up with. And if I thought that I would be anchoring the demise of the American democracy when I first started working here, if you told me that 8 years ago, I would have asked you what planet you were from. But that is precisely what is happening. There was no fraud in Michigan. These measures are, and I'm curious whose strategy this was, whose legislative strategy this was. We know a lot of the voter suppression, voter nullification laws are coming from think tanks in Washington, D.C. I just have questions about where this one came from. But the demise of democracy is happening in full view, predicated on a lie, designed to make it harder for people to vote and to politicize the people who count the votes. This is just today's exhibit.
Well, it is. And Secretary Benson did a good job of putting this into context. This is almost on two tracks. I mean, it strikes me that when you look at the actual substance of it, there's a certain cleverness to what they are doing. Because if this becomes a referendum and a debate over voter ID, the fact is that the majority of voters support voter IDs. People don't see that as anti-democratic. Even large numbers of minority voters support voter ID. But the other track is that this is happening specifically to advance the big lie, to continue the myth that there was something deeply wrong with the election. So when you ask the question, why is this being done? Is it being done for the specific changes and tweaks to hold down the turnout? Maybe that's a side benefit. But I think it's this larger drumbeat to convince people that the election, in fact, was fraudulent, when in fact the evidence is overwhelming that it's not. This is a way of keeping that big lie alive. And you're right, you're seeing this all over the country. I was just reading a letter from legislators all over the country who are asking for a 50-state audit, the possibility of decertifying the presidential election, the possibility of calling the House of Representatives, into session to deal with all of this. Look, this is crazy talk, but it is to keep the fires burning. And that's what's really dangerous.
Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, thank you so much for being part of our conversation. When we come back, among the names in yesterday's batch of subpoenas from the January 6th Select Committee, two conservative operatives described as the Bonnie and Clyde of MAGA world. That reporting is next.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Each one of the individuals who received a subpoena today apparently had a role in raising money for the rally on the 6th, and in some cases, so-called Stop the Steal rallies earlier, in December. And so we want to follow the money, find out how this whole riot was planned and paid for and the like.
Follow the money. If you followed Trump's presidency or you watch crime shows on TV, you already know it is a tried and true practice of any complex investigation. And the January 6th Select Committee's probe into the insurrection is no exception. That was Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren referring to those five subpoenas issued yesterday by the Select Committee. Those subpoenas targeted key players in the organizing and financing of the rallies that ultimately led to the attack on the Capitol, including high-profile folks like Roger Stone and Alex Jones. Two of the lesser-known figures who were also subpoenaed yesterday, Dustin Stockton and Jennifer Lawrence. They're referred to in a comprehensive profile in Politico as, quote, the Bonnie and Clyde of MAGA world. From that piece, quote, the January 6th rally was, for them, the culmination of work they had been doing for the past decade, work that long predated the election conspiracy or QAnon or Donald Trump's political career. They existed on what seemed like the margins of conservative politics until... suddenly, it wasn't the margins anymore at all. Trump was the latest and most powerful vehicle for their politics and ambition. And he was what brought them to Washington on January 6th. Although you could almost as accurately say they are what brought him there, since they were the ones who helped organize much of the rally. Joining our conversation is the author of that fantastic piece of reporting in Politico magazine, David Friedlander. Charlie and Donna are back. David, I read this piece last night and had to have you on to talk about it. Explain who these figures are.
Well, thanks for having me. I mean, there are a couple of sort of tricksters in American, you know, conservative politics, and they've been at it for about 10 years now. And they, you know, they're these folks who kind of live off the land. They do antics and stunts. And in a world in which politics has kind of lived online with less trust in political institutions, they've really made a career out of that. And after the election, they organized bus tours that went around the country, rallying folks to the cause of the stolen election. But like I say, they're kind of tricksters. They do it with a little bit of like an arched eyebrow. You're not quite sure exactly what they really believe as they're doing it. And they helped organize the rally on January 6th. But they say, at least, that they kind of stopped short of the rally that then went to the Capitol, then the siege of the Capitol later that day.
Let me play some of Mr. Stockton at the January 5th rally.
Obviously, we know what's going to happen at the Capitol and that we need these legislators to do the right thing. We need them to look at the evidence that this election was stolen and then do the right thing, because if our votes don't count, nothing counts. We're going to try to give you guys real-time updates about what's happening in the Capitol, if it goes to the Supreme Court, and where we need people to be.
So what I want to understand, David, is this from the subpoena yesterday. This is in Mr. Stockton's letter. According to press reports, you and others working for and with Women for America First to organize the January 6th rally collectively communicated with President Trump, White House officials, including Mark Meadows, and others about the rally and other events planned to coincide with the certification of the 2020 Electoral College results. You reportedly were concerned, quote, about plans by the Stop the Steal movement to organize an unpermitted march that would reach the steps of the Capitol as Congress gathered to certify the election results, so much so that you and others, including Amy Kremer, WFAF's chair, quote, felt they needed to urgently warn the White House of the possible
danger. You were aware of that view, a last-minute march without a permit, without all the Metro police that would usually be there to fortify the perimeter, felt unsafe. Tell me whether, what should we read into that, what the Select Committee seems to understand about their efforts to communicate, and the letter indicates directly with Trump and Mark Meadows.
Well, what they say is that they were planning for this rally on first all, rally on the 5th and then a rally on the 6th. And that what happened was that then some other figures in the sort of far-right sphere got to the White House, got to President Trump. And they're the ones who urged a march to the Capitol after that original rally at the Eclipse rally. And so they say that this thing got away from them. And they're ready to tell their story about that because they feel as if they were doing, you know, quote unquote, the right thing by having a sort of peaceful rally right where the president said to be.
But what did they think they were would happen? They were spoon feeding Donald Trump's base a lie. I mean, I guess I'm just unclear on what line they're drawing, that they wanted people to be there. They just didn't want them to engage in what Harry Dunn called medieval hand-to-hand combat. I mean, what line in their heads do they think they have drawn?
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely going up to and past the line of incitement. I mean, when you hear that language that you played, some of the language at the rallies, I mean, it's frightening and it's anti-democratic. So to, you know, reference your earlier segment, for sure. They would say they were echoing what the president said. They certainly did not intend for anybody to sort of leave where they were and go march on the Capitol, let alone sort of surround and siege the building. But of course, there were other figures who were urging that on and who did get to the president, and then the president urged that on. But look, I agree with you. I mean, these folks, they're like, they see themselves kind of like the Hunter S. Thompson of the American right. I mean, you know, they're tricksters and provocateurs. And so you got to obviously take it with a little bit of grain of salt, whatever they say.
It's so interesting, though, David, because you go through this game of relativity, right? Like, you look at all the bad guys and you're like, well, they're like not as bad as the Oath Keeper guys who said, bring your weapons. But they're worse than, I mean, but you're right. It is an incredible piece of reporting. I'm really glad that we got to talk to you today. David Friedlander, thank you so much for joining us. When we come back, why is the RNC using their money, party funds, to pay some of the disgraced ex-president's legal bills in the investigation into his businesses? That new reporting is coming up after a quick break. Don't go anywhere. There's brand new reporting in the Washington Post that gives us today's evidence of the GOP's unwavering and unflinching subservience to a former president impeached twice, who has not announced another campaign, evidence in the form of tens of thousands of dollars to cover some of his personal legal bills. Washington Post reports that in October, the RNC agreed to make, quote, two payments totaling more than $121,000 to the firm of Trump's lawyer, Ronald Fischetti, as Trump faces dual investigations into his business practices in New York. The committee came right out and said it. As a leader of our party, defending Trump and his record of achievement is critical to the GOP, and frame the investigations as a political witch hunt. We're back with Charlie and Donna. These aren't witch hunts, and even if they were, they have nothing to do with his time as president, Charlie.
No, and it's extraordinary that a political party would use donor funds in this way for the defense of the private business of the former president. But look, I mean, there's two things at work here. Number one, Donald Trump is the ultimate cash cow for the RNC and apparently demands this as a sign of their loyalty. And the folks that are running the RNC have apparently completely lost the ability to say no, even when this is an extraordinary abuse of trust and a waste of their money.
Donna, I'm of two minds. Like, you know, one, knock yourself out, less money to spend on campaign ads against Democrats running in the midterms. And two, doesn't Donald Trump have enough money to pay his own legal bills?
Well, you know, Donald Trump never wanted to spend his own money, and it's why he charges the RNC to host their gatherings down at Mar-a-Lago. It's why he wanted everybody staying at the Trump Hotel in D.C. So that's not a surprise. And I guess I'm not shocked at all that Donald Trump is demanding for payment that these legal bills be paid. You know, if I were donors, who knows about GOP donors these days, but you know, if you're a donor and you're giving money, you're thinking that you're giving it so that you can run those ads against Democrats, but I guess not in today's GOP. But you know what? I think they should pay all of his legal bills and take up all of the money of the party to do that and let Democrats have, you know, a little bit of a ride there.
A former senior White House official in the Trump administration had told me, Charlie, that these lawsuits and these multiple fronts on which they're being waged really was draining him, both from a strategic standpoint and a financial standpoint. Do you have any sense that there's any limit to what the RNC will fund?
Oh, no. I think that we've passed every possible line of what limits the RNC will not cross. Look, I mean, Donald Trump is allegedly a billionaire himself, as you point out. He's also, how much has he raised for his various super PACs? Hundreds of millions of dollars. And yet he's insisting that apparently that the RNC bankroll this. So, look, this is the RNC could have easily said no. They've lost the ability to say no. So I don't think that there's any limit.
More money for hamburgers, I guess. Charlie Sykes, Donna Edwards, thank you for spending some time with us. We'll be back after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
It will take time, but before long, you should see the price of gas drop where you fill up your tank. And in the longer term, we will reduce our reliance on oil as we shift to clean energy. But right now, I will do what needs to be done to reduce the price you pay at the pump.
That was President Biden today announcing how his administration is getting aggressive in their effort to lower gas prices right now by taking action, dipping into some of the nation's emergency reserves. His Department of Energy will make available 50 million barrels of oil. It is the largest such release in U.S. history. It comes just in time for the Thanksgiving holiday when some 48 million people are expected to travel by car. And you heard the president say it will take time, but still, his administration is working for some much needed relief. We will be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We are grateful.
MSNBC is going to be live here all night.
Today's news requires more facts.
Palestinians and Israelis are blaming each other for the tragedy that has inflamed the region.
More analysis.
Most of the states with the worst rates of gun deaths are ones where Republicans control the state government.
And more perspective.
This is not just about women and pregnant people in Texas. This is about people across this country.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.